Back together again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, December 11th, 2024 on Connecticut Today, where I open the show looking at a Waterbury Republican American story on what's now being referred to as poly substance abuse involving alcohol, marijuana, and other drugs on Connecticut roads. CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum dropped by. He talked about the legal proceedings surrounding the accused killer of United Healthcare's CEO. Yankee Institute Director of External Affairs Bryce Chenault and Hearst Connecticut Media Colin Mist and Senior Editor Dan Haar both had their takes about a coming showdown in Hartford over state spending levels among the governor and his fellow Democrats. All righty, let me propose something here to start the show, and the answer to this is pretty evident, so I'm only doing this as a way to set this up to show you the ridiculousness of how hypocritical we are when it comes to things. Let's say in some alternate universe, there was a bill pending in front of the General Assembly in Hartford that had to do with, let's say, tobacco or nicotine or tobacco-related products. And we were pretty sure that, well, you know, if we pass this, odds are that more young people are going to use tobacco, more young people are going to use nicotine, more young people are going to use flavored vapes. And you and I both know, with the health climates being the way they are here in the state, this wouldn't stand a chance. It wouldn't stand a chance. Likewise, if there was any sort of a bill to loosen alcohol sales or in some way, shape, or form broaden the horizons of when alcohol could be sold, who alcohol could be sold to in this state, on and on and on. You know that, with probably pretty good reason, that we would see and hear testimony from people, from victims' rights groups, from survivors of family members of those who were killed by drunk drivers, health groups. The people from Yale would be up there, all kinds of youth groups, mentor groups. They'd all be up there saying, you're nuts, right? You can't do this. So efforts as far as tobacco, nicotine, and alcohol wouldn't really go anywhere, I would think, the way the, you know, the way the current, you know, the lay of the land goes. So when this was discussed, and this was brought up especially a lot on this show and other shows around the state, when it came to marijuana a few years ago, a lot of people were saying, I was saying, reading articles, I had experts on saying, hey, well, you're going to see probably a spike in drugged driving. You're going to see probably a spike in deaths because it's happened in other states. Nothing happened with that. You didn't hear a peep out of the, well, maybe you did. I don't know. I got to be careful saying that. But lawmakers didn't care. The Democratic powers that be didn't care because they wanted to, in some way, shape, or form, work their warped sense of benevolence and say to black and Hispanic people, oh, you were over-policed, so we're going to have you make money in the marijuana industry. By the way, can I ask something? Where are all these great opportunities for black and Hispanic people in the marijuana business? It's been how many years? Where's all this great wealth now that legalized marijuana was going to bring to the minority communities? Oh, that's been going great guns, hasn't it? No pun intended. Huh? So what am I saying here? Well, again, in a normal world, if something was dangerous about expanding tobacco or if something was dangerous about expanding alcohol, never would have passed. It never would have passed. But not only did marijuana pass because of a lot of white suburban guilt, but what the experts are now saying, what they said back then about, hey, you're probably after a couple of 3 years going to see a spike here, if you will, in not just drugged driving, but the mix of drinking with whatever alcohol abuse is out there, if you're above the legal limit driving, the mix of alcohol and marijuana. And, you know, people talked about this during the run-up to Legal Pot, and I said, okay, you can do whatever you want if you want to stay home and use it, but a lot of people won't do that. So by legalizing marijuana in this state, legislators, to a certain point, legalized people dying. They did, because you knew what was going to happen. How do I know this? Well, there's a really interesting story here in the Republican American of Waterbury, written by reporter Bridget Ruthman. I want to dive into that when we come back. But again, think about this. If we were to loosen the restrictions, or if there was a cadre of lawmakers in Hartford would say, hey, let's loosen up alcohol restrictions in this state, or let's loosen up the gun laws, or hey, what the heck, let's loosen up the vaping laws and the tobacco laws, they'd be shouted down. They'd say, oh, you're guns, more kids will die. Well, apparently more people have died, if you put two and two together, on the roads because of marijuana, and nobody is saying a thing. Oh, we even have a law in this state that says you're not supposed to have weed being smoked in the car. And guess what? The majority in Hartford won't let that even be enforced. Because, you know, just because there's smoke in the car doesn't mean people are high inside. No, no, no. Of course not. So 2 or 3 years ago, when we were in the midst on this show and on other talk shows around the state having a debate about whether or not to legalize recreational adult use marijuana, you know, the actual plant or the gummies or whatever, THC. I was like, fine, but you have to understand something. It's going to cause people to die. It is. And I found back then, and I still find to this day, the hypocrisy delicious. It's a nice warm plate of hypocrisy. Hypocrisy au jus, you know, with a little dressing next to it. It's like roast beef au jus. You get a little juice there, the gravy. With the side, it's hypocrisy du jour, hypocrisy au jour. Why are you saying that, Paul? Well, it's pretty simple. If at the same time I had said, well, by the way, and along with, you know, recreational use of marijuana, let's also start bills running up in Hartford to loosen up gun laws in this state, to loosen up the restrictions, maybe the age restrictions or the other restrictions on flavored vapes, nicotine, whatever. Oh, and while we're at it, let's the heck with what the feds say about road funding. Let's go from 0.8 to 0.10 on our blood alcohol level to be illegally intoxicated in the state. Now, you know as well as I do, thankfully, none of those wouldn't fly. But man, oh man, were our lawmakers in Hartford, especially those on the Democratic side, they couldn't wait to genuflect at the altar of legal weed. Now, again, what you want to do in your home is up to you. I get it. But when people like me and other hosts around the state and guests I had on both locally and nationally about this talked about the increased deaths that were going to happen, everybody's like, oh, that's nothing. We're just, so what if people die, Paul? We're a bunch of guilty suburban white people, and we want to tell black people and Hispanic people the wealth, the wonderful wealth that legal weed is going to uncover for them. How's that worked out, by the way? Yeah. 2 or 3 years, where are we? You know where we are? The governor put a kibosh on any marijuana money going to social organizations because, you know, there was graft going on a couple, 3 months ago. Didn't the governor shut down that program? But I digress. And the reason I started on this today, story today in the Republican American of Waterbury, Bridget Ruthman's story, about a new trend that is happening all around the country, in Connecticut here, and especially since marijuana was legalized. Polysubstance abuse. Ah, you know what substance means. And now you go back to your English classes. Poly, no, doesn't want a cracker. Poly means multiple. Polysubstance abuse resulting in combined alcohol and drug impairment is increasing, though no one knows by just how much, because drug impairment is more difficult than alcohol to detect. Josh Morgan with the DOT, frequent guest on the Melissa in the Morning program, saying in the story, quote, it's rare that it's a single substance impacting the ability to drive safely. In fact, they point out in this story, Richard Ruthman points out in the story that actually, I guess, single substance DUIs are actually level or down. On state roads, the number of impairment-related crashes decreased this year from 428 recorded Jan 1 through December 4 of 2023 to 404. But fatalities across the state during that time increased from 281 to 307. Most of this, wrong-way drivers. Now, this is interesting. No one knows how much of an influence cannabis plays in violations under the single heading of illegally operating under the influence, but the increase in fatalities followed similar trends in other states following the decriminalization of marijuana in June of 2021. So these increased deaths, I guess, I don't know, can you lay these deaths at the feet of lawmakers in Hartford who couldn't wait to do this? Oh, my God. These poor black and Hispanic people, they were so over-policed. That's the big word now, along with disenfranchisement. My second favorite is over-policing. Well, you broke the law. Yeah, but it was over-policed. No, you either broke the law or you didn't. What's over-policing? Stop. Is that like being a little pregnant? You either are or you aren't. Just 15 state police drug recognition experts are trained to detect the influence of a variety of drugs, especially marijuana. Another 60 officers are on local roads. So, We said, knowing what the experts said, hey, people are going to die because of this. We know most people can probably use marijuana and THC and gummy and all that and tinctures. They'll be okay. They'll stay home. But just like booze, people are going to abuse this. And we knew this. And we had people from other states. I had guests on this radio station. We knew this. Saying, hey, you know people are going to die, but they didn't care. The General Assembly, the majority party in Hartford, didn't care. Because they were under pressure from some urban legislators to say, hey, you owe us this. Well, how'd that work out? In Hartford, a recent Republican-led legislative initiative to make it easier for police to pull over drivers suspected of using cannabis was defeated. I'll read that again. In Hartford, a recent Republican-led initiative. So that means it's whenever the Democrats in Hartford see an R next to something, forget it. It could save lives. The Republican minority in Hartford could suddenly walk into the House chamber, the Senate chamber, and say, hey, look what we found buried somewhere, the cure for cancer. And the Democrats and Bob Duff and Martin Looney and everybody say, oh, Matt Ritter, can't have that. You think I'm kidding? Really? In Hartford, a recent Republican-led initiative to make it easier for police to pull over drivers suspected of using cannabis was defeated. The odor of cannabis cannot be used as the sole reason for an officer to pull over a driver. Really? Then where the hell did the odor come from? Is there a new cannabis-scented deodorant? Might that driver... Sir, is that a big fat doobie you got there? No, sir. I just used this great THC-infused deodorant. Oh, my God. The odor of cannabis cannot be used as the sole reason for an officer to pull over a driver. No. But yet, on the other hand, oh, wait a minute. We have, why are people, you know, To borrow a phrase from Led Zeppelin, in through the outdoor, why are people, geez, there's been a spike in wrong-way crashes on roads. Where could that be from? Herb tea? No. Brand muffins? No. Maybe the legalization of marijuana without the proper way to detect impairment? Don't say anything. Folks, we are so dumb in this state. I love the state. It's a great place to live. But we are led by some of the dumbest people on the planet. We pass a law that says you're not supposed to use cannabis while driving, yet we've hamstrung the cops. You got to read this story. If you have access, read this story. You've got experts here in this story. The Republican American, danger on the roads, drunk driving fuels a deadly year on Connecticut highways, but they're more concerned now. Again, this is the phrase that we've been introduced to, polysubstance abuse. It's less and less only booze. It's booze and whatever, prescription drugs, pills, whatever, and marijuana. Yet nobody, people are like, well, we have to crack down on drunk driving. We have to crack down on drug use driving. What about marijuana? Well, can't we crack down on that? What's the shush for? Oh, it's supposed to help the inner cities. Oh, it's done great, huh? And we welcome back to the telephones here at WICC, 600 AM, 95.9 FM, CBS News and legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum to try and explain to us what is going on now in the case of this suspect connected to the shooting of the UnitedHealthcare CEO in New York City a few days ago. Thane, it's Paul here at WICC. Good afternoon. How are you?
Nice hearing your voice, Paul.
Thanks, Thane. Appreciate the time. So people hear the Thane, they hear the word extradition, right? And a lot of times people say, well, wait a minute, that's when one country has somebody else. But explain the dynamic, Thane, of what's going on here between Pennsylvania and New York. What's been unfolding here?
So that's a good question, Paul. You're right. When it comes to nation to nations, countries need to have treaties in place that says, we have a treaty that if you have one of our criminals or someone who's an alleged criminal, you'll send them back. And then unless you have an extradition treaty, the countries have no obligation to do that. In states, it's a little different because there is a principle of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y. And there it's just called respect, right? We respect the fact that the crime that is alleged in your state is worse than the crime committed in our state. Right. So, for instance, even in the Trump cases, there were a number of people in Georgia that were supposed to be receiving subpoenas. And they were saying, you don't have any jurisdiction over me because this, you know, I'm in another state. Mm-hmm. And those states, including, I think, even Lindsey Graham in South Carolina said, you know what? We have comity with Georgia. And if they got a problem with you, you're going to have to make some kind of an appearance. So that's what that means. Pennsylvania has their own claims against Mangione, but they're lesser in crimes than what's being alleged in essentially second degree murder in New York. So they're saying, yeah, you know, we will extradite him. The problem is that he's contesting it. So they have to issue arrest warrants from governor to governor. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
They can't really challenge it. It's stalling. It's mucking up the gears.
So Pennsylvania, they have what, Thane? The gun charges and the ID charges, but obviously these pale in comparison to what New York wants them on.
Yeah. I mean, a really good example is what happened. Remember with the D.C. snipers of years ago?
Yeah.
So the D.C. snipers were shooting people who were getting gassed, you know, around the D.C. area. So that's, guess what? Virginia, Maryland, D.C., they were from everywhere. So when the case finally happened, all the states said, we want him in our courtroom. What do you mean? He has a date in a Maryland courtroom. He killed people from Maryland. So they literally had to sort of go one at a time, even though, ironically, one of whom was sentenced to death. So you're saying, well, why do it again? Well, because he has a date in our courtroom. And that's exactly what Pennsylvania might eventually say. No matter what happens in New York, we want to try him here for the crimes committed in our state.
Thane Rosenbaum, CBS legal analyst, with us for a few more minutes. So basically, Thane, there's nothing that Mr. Mangione can do, right, or his attorney to, you know, within the reason of law, keep him from being sent back to New York? I mean, what can they do here besides just wait for the arrest warrants? Is there anything?
The only thing they can do is have the governor of Pennsylvania say to the governor of New York, I'm not honoring this.
Yeah.
I want this guy, and, you know, we'll send him to you when we're done. But that's the only thing they can do, that they, you know, the Hail Mary is to say that the states don't recognize the reciprocal respect that normally would be accorded in this situation. Remember, this is a case that looks, you know, there's tons of circumstantial evidence, but his main defense is going to be, you don't have direct evidence of me looking at me actually shooting the gun.
Sure.
Nobody saw me do it. You know, you have all sorts of other things. I mean, it's an incredible amount of evidence, But their big defense is to say, yeah, you know, you have DNA on a coffee cup and on a wrapper that was right near where I was standing. And yeah, I did write a note that sounded like I was going to do something like this, but there's no direct evidence of me shooting that gun.
But you can still convict somebody on a second-degree murder charge on circumstantial evidence, correct or not?
Yeah. In fact, you hear that all the time, Paul, saying it's just circumstantial. Sometimes circumstantial evidence is more compelling than direct evidence. This is one of those cases, right? You're going to go, all right, fine. We don't have direct evidence. We don't have a cab driver looking at you shooting the gun. But we have so much other stuff that looks exactly like what you did. Mm. So, no, the case could, I'm sure there are criminal defense lawyers now looking at this and saying, I don't see how I could defend him. But that's his best defense, that you don't have the direct evidence of him actually firing the gun at the CEO.
Sure. A couple more questions. First, on the defense, that was one thing I was going to ask Thane. So what do we do here? Do you think that his attorney here, who I've been watching, fascinating guy, I guess he's prominent in that area. If you're his attorney, do you think they go for some sort of an insanity defense here or not?
Well, yeah, there's one possibility. He had some medical history now that suggests that this is the reason why he has this grievance against the medical industry. And there's another chance. I wouldn't be the first time you saw this in the Trump case here in New York, which is you're starting to see on social media an anti-health insurance movement, right? It's really vulgar, right? The idea that, this is a vigilante act. And when you're picking a jury here, when you ask them a question, have you had any difficulties with the insurance, health insurance industry?
During voir dire.
Every single one will. There isn't going to be one person who's going to go, oh, no, my medical health insurer is lovely. They honor all my, they're so great. They even give me more money than I need, and they come over, they make a sandwich. Like, no one will have that. And so you always run the risk during voir dire that somebody holds back and doesn't tell you how much rage they have, and they become a hung juror. They refuse to convict a guy for righteously taking out a major figure in the health insurance industry.
Thane, you mentioned voir dire, and we have an attorney on staff here as one of our hosts, and I was chatting with her, and I was wondering, Thane, not in this case, but in the Daniel Penny case, I would love to know if during voir dire in that case, Thane, did either one of the defense or the prosecution team say, hey, were you ever scared? On the subway, did you ever come in contact with somebody who you thought was physically going to hurt you? That'd be fascinating. Have you heard anything on that or not? Because they're keeping it very quiet.
I'm sure that all of them were asked, how often do you use, subway?
Yeah.
And I'm sure they, that there wasn't anyone who didn't have that experience, and feeling scared. The problem there, and I'm sure the defense, the idea would be the prosecution knows they're up against that problem. Right. In that case, that everyone may have had, because you would have hoped the prosecution, if they could ask for a change of venue, let's go to Iowa where they don't
where there's
have
no
subway. Nobody's worried about being attacked on a subway. In this case, that couldn't happen because the prosecution is the one that had the problem. But yet, let's face it. There was at least one person on that jury that at least one, if not more, that at least when it came to manslaughter, they were not prepared to say that Penny wasn't responsible for the killing.
Sure.
So, there's all kinds of prejudices in jury rooms, and that may have been one of them.
And finally, Thane, in this case, back to the UAC case, why not first degree murder versus second? Is it a question of pre-thought here or not?
No, it's an excellent question, Paul. There's a quirky thing that they have here, which is first degree murder is reserved for cops, firemen, witnesses.
Really?
Right? Yeah, they have a quirky rule on that. Second degree murder is the same thing. Apparently, it's not an accidental murder. But apparently, the explanation is that they reserve the highest of the premeditated acts for attacks against cops, firemen, or witnesses, right? Witness tampering, right?
Mob trials.
Exactly. Mob trials to set that up as the, but apparently the the severity of the crime, the elements of the crime, the amount of jail time is pretty much the same.
Excellent. Thane Rosenbaum, great stuff. Thane Rosenbaum, CBS News legal analyst. Thane, thanks, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you, sir.
Anytime for you, Paul. Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Thanks, Thane. All right, that answers the question. Hey, you know, we're going to try and get people's attention to the fact that, well, you know, in a weird way, your taxes may be going up unless we have the same sort of fiscal sanity and responsibility we've had over the past few years in Hartford. If you go to the National Review online, nationalreview.com, great story there by our next guest, Bryce Chenault. Actually, Bryce joining us, he co-authored this with another great guest from the Yankee Institute, Andrew Fowler, and the title of the piece at the National Review, Connecticut's Fiscal Death Wish. Bryce Chenault joins us from the Yankee Institute. Bryce, that sounds awfully dour. What are you trying to scare us here? What's going on here?
Hi, Paul. Yeah, thank you for having me on the program. It's great to be back.
Yeah, hey, what's going on?
I'll give full credit of the title to the good folks over at National Review.
Oh, okay. They titled it. All right. That's good.
But yeah, it's a good piece, and thank you for the opportunity to come in and talk on the topic with you here today.
Yeah, so the point here is that you and Andy are co-authoring here is what now? We're starting to hear rumblings of what, Bryce, getting away from what has given us a little bit of stability here over the past couple of years. What's the deal here?
Yeah, you know, back in 2017, there was a budget impasse up at the General Assembly, and honestly, one of the best reforms the state has made in the past, at least the past decade, if not longer, is the so-called fiscal guardrails. They installed some spending caps and made it so that government spending can't, you know, outpace economic growth, that we don't rely on very volatile funds to fund our annual budgets, and we look to pay down our massive pension debts and other long-term liabilities.
So that came in, and what have the results been so far, Bryce?
Yeah, so they've been great. They've been wonderful. Comptroller Scanlon, I would give him credit, along with Governor Lamont and Treasurer Russell, on focusing on getting these programs right. He emphasized in a CT Insider piece earlier this year where because of the improved paying down of the pension debt, because of the barriers to, you know, spending more right now on programs, you actually freed up $650 million in this year to spend on programs that everyone clamors that we need to spend more money on, whether that be social services and all the rest. So not only is it helping us in the long term, we're talking about saving billions of dollars in the long term, we're freeing up money in current expenditures because of these fiscal guardrails. So upending them, undermining them is going to disrupt that progress that we're making.
And it's interesting, Bryce, and the guest is Bryce Chenault, the Yankee Institute's Director of External Affairs. The three people you mentioned, the governor, the state treasurer, and the comptroller, last time I checked, Bryce, unless this has changed over the past 2 or 3 hours, none of these three gentlemen are right-wing Republicans here. So maybe some fiscal sanity here is causing this to develop into an interesting squabble, Democrat v. Democrat here, that could start happening as soon as January 8th.
Yeah, I think there's going to this will be a focal point of this upcoming session. What side of that debate will win within the Democratic caucus? They obviously have veto-proof majorities in both chambers if they so choose to override a governor's veto on something. So how will that discussion unfold will be a centerpiece to how the session goes. It'll impact how, you know, tax policy is discussed. It'll impact everything for the years going ahead. And your point, last year, the General Assembly voted unanimously. Everyone voted to extend the guardrails for another 5 years. So the idea that we would upend that now would fly in the face of reason and progress.
Interesting, Bryce Chenault, that in this scenario here, you talk about the guardrails, you talk about, you know, where we are now on this thing, and you talk about the fact that because of slight gains in last month's election cycle, there is that veto-proof majority. But that, as you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody on the Democratic side is going to be in lockstep here. There may be, you know, you're hearing about, well, you know, Joan Hartley in the Senate. You're hearing another few people maybe in the House who may not care about bucking their party. And, you know, I'm sure the pressure will be really on them. It's not going to be on the far left members of the House and Senate. It's going to be on some of those, what I like to refer to, Bryce, as, you know, the squishy votes sometimes who may, you know what I mean, who may be actually torn about this.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. It will, for people that are politically inclined, that'll be the debate to watch. That's where I would tune in. That'll be what matters most for this session and the overall budget, the next biennial budget.
Absolutely. Bryce Chenault, Yankee Institute, Director of External Affairs. Check out this piece once again. It is in the National Review. It's in the NRO online, so go to nationalreview.com and check it out. Hey, Bryce, thanks. Tell Andy I said hi. We'll have you on down the road. Thanks.
That's wonderful, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Thanks. All right, there you go. As he is wanting to join us every Wednesday at this time, Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media Senior Editor and columnist. Boy, do we have a lot to talk about today. Dan Haar joins us. Mr. Haar, good afternoon. How are you?
Good, good, good. I'm driving on heavy traffic in 95,
okay.
And I'm being very careful not to hit the guardrail.
Yes, please don't. Oh, very nice. Yes. I just said, Dan, before we dialed you up, that's going to be a drinking game for the next 7 or 8 months. So let's talk about the guardrails first. You wrote a story a couple of days ago of kind of a preemptive shot across the bow here by the governor's budget boss. What was that about?
The governor's budget boss, Jeffrey Beckham, who is his title is Secretary of the State Office of Policy and Management, he presented the relatively dry, relatively upbeat data on Connecticut's tax collections and a little bit of a look at the economy going ahead. And the spoiler alert is that we're fine.
Yeah.
We're probably not looking at budget surpluses as big as we had, but we're fine. But at the end of his presentation, he showed two slides, and they were headlines from 15 states, red states, blue states, northern states, southern states, Florida, Oklahoma, about really serious budget troubles that they're having. And his message, he didn't say a word about bending Connecticut's spending rules known as guardrails. All he said was, we can avoid these headlines if we are careful.
Interesting, interesting. Now,
New York, Illinois, New Jersey,
oh
Massachusetts.
My God, yeah. You know, Illinois, California, they're a mess. Now, I guess there's a Yale survey or a Yale crunching of the numbers on this. What's that about?
Well, I went into great depth with that, and my column hasn't appeared yet, but I'm up to speed on it. And what Yale wants to do is, well, I say Yale, not as an institution.
Yeah.
The group called the Connecticut Project, mm-hmm. which is a left-leaning policy group, relatively new. They've been around for a year or so. They joined with Yale, four researchers at Yale, interdisciplinary, and they came up with a way to adjust the guardrails that makes sense. In other words, what they said was, let's not argue every year about how this program should go outside the guardrails mm-hmm. and that program should go in. Let's readjust the guardrails in a way that makes sense. And basically what they said was, you know about the volatility cap. The volatility cap, for your listeners who are not up to speed, says that for any it's capital gains and partnership income.
Yeah.
And we get about $3 to $4 billion of this.
Wow.
And for any amount over a certain number, this is the guardrail that came in 2017. This is the reason that Connecticut has had all these surpluses. What it says is that for any amount of that tax money that comes from stock dividends, capital gains, and mm-hmm. partnerships, law firms, that kind of thing, anything over a certain amount we're not allowed to spend. It has to go into surplus, usually to pay down the pension. And the idea was, let's pick an amount that we know we're going to get every year, and everything over that will sock away. And what the Yale researchers are saying is, look, every single year we're getting $500 million to $3 billion more dollars than that.
Wow.
Let's readjust it, not by raising the threshold, but by looking back and basing the amount we must save on 5 years of data. So if the last 5 years show that we've made $1 billion more than the guardrail says, that becomes the new guardrail.
Interesting.
Right? So that's one change they suggested. The other is when you look at the spending cap, which is easier to understand, right? Every yeah. year the state spends X amount
yeah.
and it is allowed to spend 4 or 3 or 5% more than that based on the some economic data, right? What Yale's report says is rather than just have a relatively arbitrary increase every year,
mm-hmm.
let's go back in time and see what what would have been the spending limit if Connecticut had spent the maximum it could spend every year.
Got it.
Right? So if 1 year, and 2018 is the real year, Connecticut didn't spend up to the cap for whatever reason. What the Yale report is saying is let's go back to 2018, and for all the years since then, let's adjust the cap upward as if we had spent to the cap, because that's a fair way of spending. And, of course, conservatives, Republicans, and the governor are saying, you know, howl, howl, howl. You people are crazy, and you're just looking for new ways of spending money.
Are you sure there were three howls in there and not four? Because you did that well. I like that. Howl.
We have a howl. We have a guardrail on the number of howls there can be.
Okay. A couple of more quick things. I don't think it's anybody's surprise. The governor has picked a law firm to look into. Are we calling this Cargate or the use of these state
cards? Cargate.
Yeah. So it's a well-known law firm, right, if I remember correctly?
I have actually not looked at the name of the law firm, but I'm very up on the issue.
Okay.
So what I can tell you about the issue is there are two distinct things going on here, right? One is, oh, my God, members of the governor's immediate staff, and there are about 6 or 8 of them. It's not a big staff. We don't have a big, fat governor's staff.
Yeah.
Right? Members of there may be a little more than that, but it's a lean, lean staff. It's not a department like DCS.
Mm-hmm.
Of the governor's staff, oh, my God, they took one of the two cars.
Yes.
And they used it on things that were not entirely for business.
Okay.
Right? And to that, I have to say this. If you're the chief of staff, let's say Matt Brockman, right, or the previous chief of staff who was named in the reports, right, Johnny Dodd, you're working 24/7.
Yeah, you are.
If you need a car to go to an event. Now, look, people know Johnny Dodd didn't own a car, right? And God bless him for not owning a car. He was trying to be a good urban, conscious, ecologically conscious guy.
Yeah.
Right? He took the train to work from New Haven.
Okay.
Right? So if one day Johnny Dock, and this is the real life example because he was named in the reports, if one day Johnny Dock had to go to see somebody for work in Brookfield and took the car, was he supposed to then take the car back to the office and take a late 11 or an Uber?
No, of course
that's
not.
Ridiculous.
No, Dan, you know what? Honestly, I think to cut to the chase on this, that doesn't bother me. I think the speeding thing, though, that's
The 113 miles an hour. So what I'm saying is that the law firm should be looking into excessive speed, not who takes the car. Who cares who takes the car?
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that. It's the whole speeding thing. I'd love to talk health care. We'll get to that next week because I'm up against it time-wise. But I agree with you. I mean, come on. Yeah, I mean, look, the guy, it's a company car. How many thousands of people in Connecticut, Dan, have company cars? Come on, seriously, right?
And what we have to remember is if you're on the governor's staff, whether you're the communications director or the general counsel or the chief of staff or the deputy chief of staff, you're on call 24/7.
Yeah, you are.
And if you don't think that's true, go FOI the phone calls and you'll see that it's true.
Yeah. Dan Haar, you take it carefully on the roads in the rain. Dan Haar, Hearst, Connecticut Media. Dan, we'll chat next week. Thank you, sir.
Great to be here. Talk to you soon.
Appreciate it, Dan Haar.